following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right. It is that time of the week again. It's time for the True Wealth Radio Show on this, the greatest Tuesday you've had all week. I'm your host, Dave Littlejohn, and joining me in studio, as always,
Matt Dixon.
Matt.
Yeah.
I am stoked for today. We are going to talk about money.
How much of it? All of it?
You know what? We're the parts about money that we don't talk enough about. How about the cost of money? That would never make sense to people when you first say it. Like, how much does money cost? Wait, does not compute?
Right.
Totally compute. So we're going to be unpacking that today.
I like it.
Me too. Because I don't know if you... I did not actually catch it. Did you listen to any of the stuff with Congress today when Jerome Powell was talking?
No, I missed it. Did you get some of it?
No. No. I'd be like, I don't know about you, but I was working.
I kind of saw like a little bit of a summary recap, but it wasn't much of a recap. It was mainly headline articles of like, Powell...
Let me guess. We're going to keep looking at the data. And we're not sure yet.
Yeah, it seems like Powell is looking at this and saying, well, we'll figure it out later. It's kind of kicking the can down the road.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that sounds familiar, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the most modern thing?
But there might be a reason behind it.
Oh, go on.
Well, that's what the show is, right? Like, you got to stick around to the very end to find out.
Yeah, so if you've never listened to the show before, welcome True Wealth Radio Show, where we talk about basically all things surrounding your money. Of course, we're big on the game of more being the wrong game to play, right? If you're trying to play the game of I just need more, you'll never win and you're going to be really unsatisfied. So that's why we talk about true wealth. It's going to include the stuff that really moves the needle in your life. So, but money's part of it, right? It is part of it. Money's how we trade our time.
Yeah.
Right? I think the memories, the relationships, the experiences, those are the things that are going to really matter. But oftentimes it takes money to do it, so we don't want to be bad stewards, right?
Correct.
Okay, so with that as the backdrop, we're going to talk a little bit today about how money gets priced and why you care.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, you probably, if I were to sort of, for our listeners, if you're going, what do you mean by how money is priced? This happens a lot, although you may not deal with it very often.
Is it because, like, the availability of money can change? Is that kind of the angle you're going for here?
Part of it is that. I think if we really wanted to look at it, it's how the market is determining risk.
Okay.
Okay. Like invariably, what happens is if you're going to take on a risk, then you need to be compensated for the risk, okay? But risk is associated, like cost of capital is actually a calculation of risk, right? It sounds weird, but remember, sometimes in the financial world, we will use terms that, they sort of have like, one word has lots of meanings. Risk has lots of meanings, okay?
Yep.
Capital. Largely has the same meaning, but sometimes different contexts give you different implications, right? And so today we want to talk about, but let me start with first something. It's not even our notes, but it's just a good way to help people understand the cost of capital. Exchange rates, right? If you think about, hey, if I want to go into a different country, how much does it cost me to exchange one currency for another?
Right.
Why does it change? Why is it that it's not always the same, that the currencies are just, well, this is just what the exchange rate is all the time?
Well, if you feel like a currency is more risky, right? Like some stuff is going on behind the scenes with that government, for example. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're like, well, that value of that currency might be a little less than it was a couple days ago because that country just went to war that they can't afford.
Sure. So it's the idea that things are not static across borders, right? Mm-hmm. Different economic outputs create different. Now, here's the simplest illustration. Anybody ever done like a group project in school?
Yes.
Right? Yeah, and if you get a group project that's got more than about five people in it, somebody isn't doing anything.
Right.
Right? They're just going to kind of hang out and let everybody else do all the work. And the people that want to make the grade, what do? They bust tail and they make sure that they get the grade. And somebody comes along for the free ride, right? something, a little something. I think it's called the social loafing theory. Okay. Maybe I'm wrong, but it sounds great, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Social loafers. Ugh. But what happens if you have differing productivity in a country, right? If we had different productivity in a business, right? Hey, I could hire two different people. One of them, I pay the same either way, but like one person can do twice as much as the other person in the same amount of time. Are they worth the same? Right? Now, somebody out there is going, well, how do you value a human life? And then I want to slap you, right? Because I'm like, you did that on purpose. You're not playing the game.
It's kind of what Elon ran into when he bought Twitter, right? It's like, wait a minute. I've got all these employees, and if I fire 60% of my workforce and the job still gets done the same.
Yeah, right? And so there's all kinds of implications. We're not going to go into that on the show today, the squares rule and the Pareto principle and some other elements of that that are kind of novel. But the point is that there's a reason that exchanges are like that. Well, guess what? If one person is less reliable than another person, they're riskier as an investment.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're less valuable as an investment. So when you're, but you know, we're talking about exchange rates, we're talking about global economies, policy. You can have everything from different birth rates to productivity rates to proliferation of technology to the way that the government allows or disallows things to happen in the economy.
Right.
Right. So there's a lot of things that can make for differences in production and output.
And didn't the U.S. just see a downgrade on its credit rating, right?
Yeah.
And so this country's taken on a ton of debt. The balance sheet doesn't look great. And so the creditors are looking at that and saying, well, this is a riskier investment.
Yeah. What's the probability that I get paid back? It's still really high,
but
except
not
that maybe the currency value isn't as good in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the market make up for that? Several ways, but one of them is it will change the currency exchange rate.
Mm-hmm.
The other is the cost of capital, which is the interest rate that is charged in the economy, right? Whenever somebody says, like, well, how much does my bank savings account make? It's like nothing, right? It's like pono nothing.
Yeah.
That's a sign that it's low risk, so they don't have to pay you to convince you to keep your money there. Okay, if they want you to keep your money around for a year, what do they do? We'll have a one-year CD. We'll pay you 4% for a year. These are all, you know, hypothetical numbers, right?
Right.
Kind of grounded in reality right now. So that's the cost of capital to the bank. It costs them 4% to convince you to stick around for a year. So the cost of capital is we buy your money for 4%.
Correct.
That's also a risk factor now, right? Oh, well, that's the risk that they have to be. You have to be willing to trade your money for 4% and your risk of getting paid back versus the reward or opportunity that you're going to give up. You needed to get paid at least 4% for that to make sense for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There you go. And that's kind of how capital works. Like, that's how we price risk in a very basic format. Now, layer 17 trillion variables on top of it and figure it out.
Yeah.
Right? Isn't that kind of what we're talking about now? It's like, well,
it
what about oil? And what about geopolitical risk? And what about the Federal Reserve and monetary policy? And what about banking reserves? And what about interest rates for home mortgages? And what about wealth effect? And what about whether or not there are different regulations from state to state that make it dissimilar in one state versus another for development? And you go, like, oh my gosh.
It's such a more complicated equation than what people really want to give it, you know.
I don't know that it's actually a solvable equation. I think what you end up doing is saying, how many variables are enough, and can I guess at which variables are the most relevant?
Well, and the market tries to guess, right? It tries to get out ahead of this, and it's like, well, you know, the Fed fund rate went up, and so then you look at that, and you're like, well, how does that affect this, and how does that affect the next thing?
Exactly.
And so it's this trickle-down effect, and at the end of the day, that can make like when you tinker with something just a little bit, you can have a huge effect. But
it's
what
the butterfly effect, right? The concept of, like, if a butterfly flaps its wings in China, can it create a hurricane on the other side of the world?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and if you tinker with something just a little bit and there's a profound effect, let's think about what actually happened. We had interest rates really low for really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then Powell comes along and raises the rates because inflation is spiraling out of control. And he didn't just raise it a little bit. He raised it a lot. And all of those effects, I don't think, have actually fully worked their way through the system.
Oh, and so, and there's so much to this, right? Because you go way, like, go back into the 2008 and the real estate collapse.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then what happened is rates had to go to near zero in order to stabilize the interest rate market. Or, right. Sorry, the real estate
market. You had to bring the buyers back into the
so
market.
So you had to basically make money super, super cheap in order to get it to circulate in the economy again.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that was that then a bunch of people locked into real estate at super low rates, and now rates are not anywhere near though, right? And people will go, well, 7%'s not bad. It's like, it's bad compared to 2%. Mm-hmm. Your borrowing power is way different at 7% than 2%.
Right.
And for anybody that said, well, I remember when it was 18%, it's like, yeah, but we're not in that landscape.
Well, and here's the hard part. Just a few years ago, you know, it's 2-something percent. Well, it's probably more than that now. It's
call
probably
three,
been, yeah, three know? Or four. But still, if you get a ton of people who load up at a cheap interest rate,
mm-hmm.
and then you completely change the system, what does that incentivize people to do? Hold on to the cheap money.
Yes.
Right? And so I think that's what we're facing kind of right now is everyone was able to loan at historically rock bottom rates, and then you just ratchet the interest rates up. Where's the spending going
to
come from?
There's more to it than that, but let's do this. I want to explain, like, what was another knock-on effect of super low rates, okay? And I'll give you a hint. It has to do with our, like, college graduates today.
Okay.
Okay, so what's how do those two connect?
Does it have anything to do with borrowing?
I'm going to make you wait.
Okay.
We're going to come back. When we come back, we'll talk about exactly how those things are connected. But we got to take this first break first. So stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM, 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with...
Did you vomit in your mouth at all?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, you guys missed it. Matt and I are talking. By the way, we are streaming live on YouTube right now, so if you want to hear the in-between... You can actually go and
you
check
miss
it out.
About half the show, yeah. If you're not watching live.
So Littlejohn Financial, look it up on YouTube. You can see us streaming live, and you can see good looking Matt and the other guy in the studio.
Yeah.
And so what? And also, this will be podcasted. If you want to catch it up later, go to littlejohnfs.com. You know the drill, right? But we're talking about the fact that rates were super low a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens to young people today? Now, first I want to share what you said. Will you tell the audience like what you were telling me? Like,
yeah,
you thought I was wrong.
I thought you were angling at the fact that basically one of the systematic problems is you got this younger generation that borrowed as much money as they could, right? Because interest rates were cheap. And so they looked at their budget and they said, I can afford this much a month in payments. And they took on student loan debt. They took on, you know, housing debt, vehicle loans, and they maxed themselves out. Now that the rates have gone higher, they can't afford to borrow any more money. That's where I thought you were going.
Right. But I wasn't going there.
No, you were going somewhere completely different.
Which is fine, because I think what you're saying is there's probably some real truth to that. I don't know that everybody maxed themselves out, but the problem is what it looked like to max yourselves out then versus now, you could be underwater, because if you maxed yourself out and then any variable rates went up on you, you're really in trouble, right?
Oh, yeah. For the person who had a variable rate loan, oh my gosh,
right.
You're just getting pummeled.
Here's my issue. I look at housing and I say, over the last 5 to 7 years, houses probably went up 30-35% in price on average. Right, maybe more.
I think that it close to doubled. I know, like the house we bought, it's doubled in
price.
Some
houses went up extravagantly, but let's just do the simple math on this one, right? Let's say that like average house price went from like 180 to probably like 350, 360. I guess it did double.
It doubled.
So if you have a $360,000 house at current mortgage rates, right? First of all, you got to figure out how to put about 20% down or find a specialty first-time buyer program, right?
Right, so come up with what? 30?
Let's say like 5% down even. You still need to come up with 20 grand almost.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and almost no one's doing 5. 10's kind of the minimum. So just factor, you know, $36,000.
Okay. And then realize that you're going to have a mortgage payment of around $3,500 a month, right? So that's like $42,000 a year. We just did the rough math. If you're in about a 25% blended tax rate between federal and state, you're going to, and you're spending 40% of your income on just the mortgage payment, right? You need to have at least $140,000 worth of family income to even come close to sustaining that, right? And I think median family wage in Oregon is something like $68,000. Okay, so the dream of home ownership is being shattered in real time because home prices didn't roll back and interest rates went up. So buying power went way down while home prices are way high. And we have all these structural problems in the economy. Why I say structural? Look at how much it costs for building permits. Look at how much it costs to put infrastructure in to just prepare a lot to build a home.
Yeah.
And then look at the cost per square foot to build it. And you go, there's no such thing as an affordable house.
No, I mean, when the cost to tap into a sewer line is $10,000.
Yeah.
Like, and then, you know, the cost to tap into the water line is another $7,000. It's like, you almost have $20,000 just in some fees to access the thing. And so it's like, you're not going to build a home without putting $80,000 to $100,000 in just on the pad, the utilities, and the electricity.
Yeah. Now,
what is happening?
I'm going to say something really brutal that's kind of, it's like aimed at people. There's a group of people that says, see, this is just proof capitalism failed, right? And I'll go, hold on, right? Because I don't think there's another like monetary economic system that's going to be superior to it. What's failing here is the disconnect of all of the various parts that all put protective moats around themselves. And then it's the compounding effect of that, right? You can't have every organization trying to maximize profit and then using the government to mandate it, right? So that there's no competition and it's a mandatory deal.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If we keep doing that and we strip competition out of the marketplace and then we give people essentially modified monopolies, like oligopoly style behaviors, right, then what else is going to happen? That's the natural pathway, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I throw rocks at a lot of union activity because I say, like, if you're negotiating in a union and the counterparty is the taxpayer is not really represented.
Correct.
Right. And so, like, it's not a real negotiation. It's just the union organizing to try to get whatever organization they're working with to give as much of the cash flow to them in the form of payments and benefits as possible. And what that does is it degrades the service over time because it just sort of waits the boat to one side until it capsizes. And then you end up with these structural problems where it's like, well, you have, you know, a monopoly environment. I mean, shoot, before we got in here. And I'm not listening to Lars Larson a lot these days, but like saying ODOT has 5,000 employees. You go, does it take 5,000 employees? Like, really?
Right.
That's a crazy number.
That's a lot of 5,000 people. Because New Zealand employed, what, 600?
Like, it's just, it's the nature of where everybody's like, yeah, but I want this job where I've got all this security and the taxpayers funding it. And I go, but we're choking ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, this state's running a massive deficit. And it's like,
it's not just Oregon. So many states
Washington's
are doing this.
I think even worse. And it's,
you know, and of course it sounds like a complaint fest, right? I don't mean to degrade into a complaint fest, but I mean, let's not throw rocks at the system like the system failed. Parts of the system that don't have natural competition are failing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the problem. If you don't have price discovery and competition in capitalism, it breaks. Right? You have to have competition and you have to have price discovery. Same problem in medicine, right? How can you expect a doctor to help control costs if they don't even know what it costs? They just know that if I don't do this test, I'm liable for it. So I have to control my liability. So I'm doing the test, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's where they're at. And so, and I don't know what it costs. So it's like the Las Vegas mini bar for the doctor performing medicine. Right, I love that analogy because Vegas is notorious for like, sure, have anything you want in there. And then they bill you afterwards. They don't tell you what it costs. You just know after you took it that it's going to cost a lot. And then you're like, oh my gosh, that was a $13 bottle of water. Wow. Right?
Right.
So that's the issue. If you don't have price discovery, it's not a natural market.
Well, and I think all of this kind of wraps up into, we've seen inflation be really pesky, right? Like, stuff like what we're talking about is inflationary when you have a ton of government jobs and the wages are really high there. You start adding it all up and it's like, well, you got to kind of feel bad for Powell in a way, right? Because it's almost like he's been put in a corner. You've got inflation that's over the, what, isn't it 2% the target?
And 2%'s been their historical target. And then it was too low for a long time, and then it shot up really high.
Well, we've been hovering at like 2.5, so inflation's still pesky. We see that. The unemployment picture, still relatively low, but wage growth seems to be kind of moderating.
Yeah, well, unemployment's a weird one because we're, you know, with the aggressive, basically going aggressively after the black market economy, which has largely been folks that have entered the country, you know, illegal, undocumented, whatever you're going to call it. I'm not trying to pick fights right now. I'm just talking reality.
Right.
If you start deporting a whole bunch of folks that are in the bottom end of the black market economy, maybe you don't see it in the form of the jobs that disappear, but you'll see it in the form of like the labor force is changing a lot.
Yeah.
And it is the black market jobs that are going away, which means you're left with, it tends to drive wages higher because the workers are left, if they'll go to work, get paid more. But the problem with that now is that's inflationary and it's back to the pesky corner that Powell's, you know, cornered with.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear Vance talk about that. They were interviewing him the other day, and they were talking about exactly what you just mentioned. And they're like, how do you combat this problem? Because what if there aren't the people there to fill those jobs? And his theory, at least, was, I think that there are people there to fill it. And he said the unemployment rate doesn't speak to the whole picture. We have, and he cited like over 4 million like
working age men that aren't working right now. They're between just, the ages of like 18 and 59.
Right. And basically,
they've just withdrawn from the workforce.
Yeah. And his theory was they've withdrawn because all of these low level paying jobs or entry level jobs, right? Like in someone who's an apprentice carpenter or someone who could come in and build the homes, for example, they cannot. Like, why work for below minimum wage salary for a position that's being filled by someone who is working illegally, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of forced a large group of people out of the workforce. And if you open those jobs back up, his theory was at least, well, now you might see a lot of people re-entering the workforce, and it really starts to change what we view as kind of that baseline unemployment rate.
Yeah. My theory is less to do with whether or not it works and more to do with the fact that you can't just allow something that's broken to be broken because it's too hard, too painful to fix it.
Right.
You know, and that's the issue, is it? So, well, you know what? We look the other way on the black market economy, which is effectively breaking the law, because it just, I think it would hurt to fix it, and let's pretend it's not really broken.
Like, it's like that same reason why people like choose not to work out,
it's
right?
Putting
like
a bucket under the leak instead of patching the roof, right? Yeah. Eventually it gets worse. It's not a solve.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's the issue, is that we have kind of comforted ourselves to the point that we allow those things to happen a lot. We're just saying, well, you know, we need to be compassionate rather than being consistent. My big thing is, if we don't like the laws, change them, right? But don't just selectively enforce them. That's a catastrophe.
So does it feel a little confusing to you when we've got high rates, but the groceries are still kind of expensive? The market has gone to basically all-time highs, right? Like, and the Fed is sitting there like on its hands a little bit, like, what do we do? Is it confusing? Or
so it's,
do
you, I don't think you haven't, it's not super confusing to me, but okay. I suspect to a lot of folks that it is, because the cause and effect are not always intuitive.
Okay. Do you want to talk to that a little bit?
You know, I think we should. This is truly the concept of where the cost of capital, it's where the rubber meets the road, right? But yeah, we should. But I'm looking at the clock and I'm thinking, you know, this is probably prime time.
Okay.
Why don't we grab our next break? We'll do that. So we'll cue the music. Yeah, perfect. And I want everybody to stick around, okay? When we come back, let's talk a little bit about, okay, why is everything expensive and rates are still high? Like, this seems like it's broken, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. or are we moving in a different direction? We'll discuss. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You got True Wealth on News Radio 92.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, hey, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. So Matt asked me the question.
During the break, yeah.
Yeah, during the break. Like, can I believe that the yield curve has been inverted this long? It was inverted for quite some time before 2008.
Yeah.
Really happened. Yeah, it was months before everything kind of
but
rolled
how
over.
Long's it been inverted this time? It seems like multiple years now.
I don't know if it's been years or not.
It's definitely been more than 12 months.
Well, I will say that the aggressiveness of the inversion of the curve has been kind of a tricky one. Like, it mm-hmm. wasn't badly inverted. I know that now we're kind of splitting hairs here. This is really important for folks to understand. An inverted yield curve, it used to be, well, that just means that the market's going to go down. No, it doesn't.
No, because it's been inverted for a while and the market's gone up. How, like what?
Right. Well, and there's that expression, right? A broken clock is going to be right twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, okay, just keep saying the market will go down. And then when it finally does, you can go, see, I knew it. The yield curve was inverted.
Yeah.
And go, well, then how are we going to sync up the timing of the prediction versus the occurrence?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that's the joke when some people are perma bears or perma bulls. It's like, just always say the market's going higher and you'll be right a lot of the time. Always say it's going lower and eventually you'll be right. So you just don't change your story, right? I don't like that approach to this. So at the break, Matt, you asked this question. You said, you know, is it hard to understand that groceries and things can be so expensive right now and yet rates are so high?
Mm-hmm.
And I think my answer sort of surprised you when I said, well, it doesn't really surprise me.
And what was your answer and reasoning behind that?
Well, you know, I started to go down the path of it's a cost of capital issue, right? This is a function of risk, okay? And it's also a function of what control mechanisms can the market use in order to get prices back into alignment?
Okay.
If we're printing money, and this one, you go back to the COVID years when we started printing money and just throwing it into the economy. I remember just going, this is going to be inflationary, folks. And everybody was like, I'm going to go spend it anyway, right? Like, because in the moment, it just felt like, great, it's lighter fluid, right? It's just going to give you this instant gratification. But it's like, this isn't going to immediately find its way into the economy, but it will absolutely find its way into the data. You cannot create this much money without changing the values of assets.
Yeah.
And that's what happened, right? It's just that the speed at which it got into the system and the speed that the money was repriced into other assets took a little while.
You know what's crazy is it probably hasn't even fully worked its way in yet. Because you got to believe that there's still people out there that got that money and they're like, wow, this is like that thing I've always been dreaming of, getting that nest egg, and they're halfway decent with their money and they never even spent it. I bet it hasn't even fully worked its way in.
Well, I would suggest that that is in the economy, right? That person's behavior is unlikely to change if they've been going this long with it. They're going to just sit on that thing until it moves to somebody else.
Okay.
Right? Or that there's a forced liquidation event in their life and then they have to move it through. You know, some people are just savers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But just thinking about the backdrop here, if you see really high inflation, then what that says as an investor is, wait, if I'm a lender, okay, not a borrower, like I'm delighted if I can get cheap money and go buy a house that's going to go up and up and up in value, right? If you've got yourself a 3% mortgage and you're sitting on a house that doubled in value, you should feel really happy right about now.
Mm-hmm.
Made a whole bunch of money, at least on paper. The problem is that nobody can follow up unless they're a cash buyer to buy from you.
Well, right? That and that cash doesn't really go as far as it used to. It's like, congratulations, you have a couple hundred thousand dollars in equity, but you sell and then you take that money and you go to buy something. And if the $400,000 house became an $800,000 house, your $200,000 doesn't really matter that much with rates being at 7%.
Correct. Now you are dialing in at the crux of the problem, Matt.
Yeah.
The crux of the problem is that assets all appreciated, but all of the assets did.
Including the market, right?
And like, so, yeah. So I've actually talked about the idea of, did we have a phantom market correction when inflation goes up 6%, but your account stays flat? Right? If you don't lose money in your account, but you lose purchasing power, it's a phantom loss.
Mm-hmm.
But it's real, right? It's a phantom on paper, meaning you didn't see the loss, but you feel it because you can't purchase as much.
Yeah. I mean, right? That
makes
sense.
This is the same idea of, like, I put money in a jar and hid it away for 20 years. When I pull that money out, it's still there, but it can't buy as much 20 years later as it could back then.
Right.
And so
compared to, had you bought this thing that is either
Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Gosh, some dang crazy it. Thing. Yeah.
Now I puked in my mouth a little bit.
Yes, yes. Well, you're welcome.
Yeah.
The idea, though, of why would rates be so high now is that for somebody to be willing to loan money, they got to get paid back with enough money to stay ahead of the pricing curve too.
Mm-hmm.
They can't afford to loan you money for 2% while you go buy assets that go up in value and they don't get paid back with the money as strong.
Well, the bigger question was, why are rates so high and things are still costing so much? And I think that goes back to, well, there's still demand for the products that, like, the demand hasn't wavered largely,
oh,
right?
Oh, if it's the same demand, but everybody has more money.
Yeah.
Right? Now it's just more people competing for the same amount with more dollars in their pocket.
Exactly.
Right? If you print money, you inflate assets. And so that's what happens, is it just, because if you print money, the problem is that now you've effectively change the value of the money, which means somebody that was working for $10 an hour, well, if you dilute the money by 20%, then you get paid 20% more to break even.
Right.
Right? So
now
everybody
you
had to
12.
Get a raise,
yeah.
Which meant the products all had to go up in price in order to pay for the raises. And then we really didn't make any progress, did we?
Nope.
The way that you improve your income is not to wait for minimum wage to go up. That just works itself out in the system. You know, that's just pricing controls that doesn't work real well in capital markets, right? And, you know, I'll argue with any academician that's like, oh, it does this, that, and the other. You're just taking advantage of the slack in the system,
mm-hmm.
right? Ultimately, the system equalizes, and you can't force labor to be more valuable than it is. So what do? You make the skills better. That's what's more valuable. Like a worker with skills and decision-making and discernment and good with their tools, right? That worker is worth more than somebody that's brand new with none of those skills, right? Like an hour with a journeyman versus an hour with an apprentice is not the same value yet. It's back to the currency exchange example, right? If they're not the same value per labor unit, then you compensate them differently. So mm-hmm. you become a more valuable worker. That's how you get paid more. The job doesn't just show up and serve you. You have to become more valuable to the marketplace. That's the magic, right? So anyway, back. I know we're kind of off the path of the inflation concept, but
yeah.
Isn't that really what's going on? It's like if you print money and throw it in the system, same number of people, everybody has more money, chasing the same number of goods, then the price goes up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why did houses go up? There's actually because there's not enough houses.
Right.
People have more money.
Even though we saw some rate cuts, you know, we saw the actual opposite happen.
But what does a rate cut do? It gives somebody more buying power.
Right.
So, great. If mortgages are cheaper, I can afford more money to throw after that house. So, again, lower rates can generate higher prices because the bar for leveraged assets.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, that's what we saw. That's why when you say, well, it doesn't really surprise me. When somebody's like, I can't believe it's so expensive and rates are so high. It's like, rates are high because it's expensive. The rates will take money out of the system because it's more expensive to borrow.
Well,
right? Then the prices come down.
I think the thing that threw a lot of people is when they cut the rates, you would expect that, like, mortgage rates, for example, would go down. But they didn't. They just went higher. That was the thing that I think really threw a lot of people.
This one is one of the harder things to tackle. Matt and I talked about this during the break last time, so it was on the live stream, but okay, there's this belief that if the Fed changes interest rates,
mm-hmm.
then the market will follow suit and rates will change. And what I'm just going to blow your mind if you didn't already know this, that's not a guarantee. The Fed could raise rates and the market could say no.
Right.
Oh, we think that everything's fine. We need to speed things back up. We'll lower the cost of capital. And the market, like the lenders go, nuh-uh. Right. And that's kind of what happened with mortgages is the Fed's like, well, let's lower rates a little bit. And the
mortgage lenders didn't have to lower rates because all the buyers kept showing up and saying, well, I'll still buy.
Right. That's actually because when you have an excess demand, they can afford.
I don't even think that there was excess demand. I think there was just such a low supply. Right? Like, I think demand stayed relatively the same, but because the supply is just so thin, like,
yeah,
I think
the result is net similar, right?
It is. It's the same result.
I only have 10 houses and 100 people competing for them, then there's going to be an auction on the upside.
Mm-hmm.
If you said, I only have, if I had 20 houses, but then I had 200 people, right? It's the same ratio, right? But if I built 20 houses and I had the same 100 people, the price in theory would go down.
And now I think,
unless you gave everybody lower rates, and then they might bid the houses up anyway, even though inventory is going up.
Yeah.
Because we devalue the money.
Now, what's crazy is they're saying, now we've gotten to a point, and granted, I don't know if this is true or not, but this is what I read, that the number of sellers, right, there's like 5 sellers to every 1 buyer. So now it's gotten to the point today where there aren't buyers in the market for the homes that are out there.
So,
which is
Here's what we're going to do. Let's pause on that one. Let's take the last break because it's a good time to do it, right? Are there not buyers out there? Okay.
I think I know.
I'm
going
to ask you this question. I want everybody to think out there. Are there no buyers? Is that really what happened? Let's work our way through that. But we got to take this last break. Stick around and we'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You're listening to True Wealth on News Radio 92.9 FM, 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the home stretch of the True Wealth Show, where we are streaming live on YouTube. But
if you miss it, you can
grab it at the podcast tomorrow. It'll be at littlejohnfs.com. Just look in the Knowledge Center and you can grab it.
There we go.
Okay, Matt,
You
made a really interesting point, and I wanted to unpack this for our listeners. It was the point that you're reading that there appear to be fewer buyers in the marketplace right now.
Yeah.
And I raised an eyebrow, which all of you listening can't see, but I did.
Right? Yeah.
And then I said, hey, is that really the case?
Mm-hmm.
And your response, Matt, was, yeah, it is, because I read it. It's 100% true. That's how it works every time, right?
Sure.
Okay, that's not what he said. What is going on here?
Well, I think what happened is, inventory is low, but the buyers are very few and far between because the prices are just so outrageously high, right? And so in my mind, I think there's a bunch of people kind of hiding in the shadows like, man, if we get a 10% pullback in real estate prices, I'll show up and buy. But active buyers, people that are actually willing to pay the prices today, few and far between.
Yeah. I would say the price inelasticity is starting to show, right? This mm-hmm. idea that you can just charge really, really high amounts and it doesn't matter. Somebody will show up and they'll do it.
It's like I got this cardboard box on 0.001 acres. That's $500,000. And people are finally like, maybe not.
So this is a much crueler one. But if you want to know an example of things that are not price elastic, cancer treatment,
mm-hmm.
right? Extraordinarily expensive. And it's like, well, either you do it or you're done. Right. And so there's this incredible push to be like, well, whatever it takes, we got to figure it out. Right. There is a threshold in the housing market where you go like too much.
Yep.
Right. It's just I use this term a lot. Structural impediment. Right. The idea of, hey, people just don't earn enough money to be able to buy that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Some people you're not buying a Ferrari. Right? Because there's just not enough money to buy a Ferrari, right? So,
yeah.
Hey, go buy a Toyota. It'll be great. Car of choice. I'm not allowed to make recommendations on this show. so you know, other than here, I recommend you not be stupid. How about that? There's good financial advice. Don't be dumb, right? Don't spend money you don't have. That's a good one.
What other little nuggets do you have?
Buy low, sell high.
Oh,
I think we nailed
one.
All of them now.
Good one.
You know, don't give more to the government than the law requires you to. So there's more, but, you know, we only have so much time.
Yeah.
So, okay. I like to leave our listeners with a few important, like what are some things that we can take away from today's conversation?
Yeah. I mean, right. I think that one of the things is, you know, stuff is moving and it moves rapidly, right? And so you got to be kind of watching, right? If you're managing all this stuff yourself, if you're managing all of your own financial decisions, you kind of need to be in tune with what's going on in the world. And if you don't have someone, or like if you don't want to do it yourself, at least get an opinion on, like, are you headed down the right road?
Yeah. There are so many different strategies for how to manage the money on this one. I think there's other things that people need to consider too. I mean, consider the cost of capital. Like, think about it this way. Are you loaning money to someone else or are you borrowing money? Okay. It's pretty obvious when you're borrowing money.
Right.
But it's maybe not so obvious when you're loaning money. Like when you put money in the bank, you are loaning your money to the bank. The bank will loan it to somebody else and charge them interest, right? And they will charge them more interest than they're paying you. And that's how they make their money.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you have to consider that's a lot of what drives things. When we talk about the cost of capital, it's the cost to borrow and the cost to lend, and how dangerous is it to do either of those?
Well,
and how will people price that and agree to do the borrowing and the lending?
I think a lot of Americans don't really understand their own cost of capital, right?
Oh,
where
yeah.
It's like, you look at the liabilities that you've taken on personally, and what is that costing you? Because mm-hmm. if you don't understand that, and then you might have a variable interest rate loan or something, and then you're asleep at the switch, like, you could get buried, right? Like, there are people that are foreclosing on things. Like, delinquency is up.
It
don't
is.
Don't be mistaken. It's up.
Yeah. Here's another free piece of advice that I think really needs to be considered, okay? The idea that if you can cash flow it, you can afford it.
Oh, gosh.
I think this is a really tragic mindset that's very common.
Yeah.
In the United States these days, and it is just this idea of like, well, if I get a raise, that means that I can go out there, and if I buy something on a credit card, as long as I can make the payments, and as long as if I get a loan from somewhere, and as long as I can make the payments, then it's cool, right? I can go do this. But you are essentially putting golden handcuffs on yourself. And you may be putting golden handcuffs on both your hands and your feet, and then mm-hmm. being thrown into a river. Right. And in that river has a high current and it's dangerous. Right. And now you've handicapped yourself in the ability to navigate.
Yep.
Right. It's a silly analogy. How far will we carry it? It's not a good idea. Right.
Correct.
And so does that mean you should never use debt? You know, Dave Ramsey would say that. But then he also says, well, you might get a mortgage. Right. I think what he's trying to say is,
don't take on liabilities that are going to cost you more than they provide for you.
Well, I think just the don't take on liabilities, right?
Yeah.
Like if you're using any kind of debt, it's you really want them to be assets. You want them to be appreciating whenever possible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you want to be very cognizant of the fact that, you know, you doing this is putting yourself in a position where things can go wrong and they can bite you.
This is a weird moment in history, though, right? Because you just said, well, you know, take on the assets. I'm almost starting to wonder, like, traditionally, we've always looked at homes like an asset, right? But if you were walking into this market today and you didn't own any real estate and you didn't have a whole lot of money down, are you actually buying an asset? You know what I mean? Like, you have to start asking that question, I think, right now. Because if you can go rent for $1,200 instead of have a $3,500 a month mortgage payment that is going to take every penny you have for the next 30 years and you're going to be a slave to that mortgage, I don't know that that is an asset anymore.
Yeah, I think that rent is a lot less crazy than it's been in a long time.
Yeah.
I know that there are some calculators that are out there too. We have one on our website if you want to go look at rent versus buy calculators. If that's something that you'd like us to cover in more depth in a future show, we could do that. Just let us know. Send us an email at info@littlejohnfs.com.
Right.
Or you can send us a text to 541-375-0898 and just say, yeah, you know, I want to know about the, you know, when should I rent versus when should I buy? Mm-hmm. Okay? And of course, we can't ever do the official advice, but what we could do is walk you through, well, how do you analyze the decision?
Yeah.
And what are some of the tools that are available to you? And, you know, when does it make more sense and less sense?
Yeah.
Right? 'Cause you're right. I mean, the housing market seems very out of balance.
Traditional assets aren't, they're not, I don't think that they're paying the way that historically they have. And I think real estate is one of the bigger ones. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you also got to consider like a really low yield money market, right? Like if it's paying 4% and inflation, they claim is at 2.5 or whatever, when it's really more like maybe 5 or 6, if we're being honest with ourselves, I'm like, you actually might be walking it back.
Yeah.
You know, true. Like, let's just be honest about it. So traditional asset classes maybe aren't assets. That's my little nugget.
Ooh,
for you.
That's such a loaded statement. That may be a topic for the next show, is when is an asset not an asset, right?
Ooh, I like that. Let's unpack that one.
When is an asset not an asset? But look, we are really out of time for today. So I want to leave you guys with a couple of thoughts. If you're out there and you've got somebody that you were working with, awesome. Right, I'm glad that you've got that and you got somebody in your corner. Leverage that where you can. If you were doing it yourself, then keep using resources. We got a ton of podcasts and stuff that where we cover this kind of stuff. But if you're out there and you're somebody going, you know, I just would like to second opinion, or I'd like to, you know, get some more information, how can they reach us, Matt?
Yeah, why don't you give us a call at 541-375-0898, or you can shoot us an email at info@littlejohnfs.com. You can text our phone number, go to the website. There's a lot of ways to get a hold of us.
Yeah, but the key on this one, it's not supposed to be a pressure thing.
No.
Okay, this is supposed to be a second opinion.
We're not charging for that consultation, so what's the pressure?
Yeah, and we don't, right? So you can do it whenever you want, but... and look at that. With that, there is officially the music. So apparently we are out of time.
Okay.
Hey, I want to thank everybody that's taken the time to join us on YouTube or listen live today.
Yeah.
If you got more questions, let us know. We want to cover them. But until next time, we got to run. So I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
You've been listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM at 1240 KQEN.